Hello and welcome to the latest edition of Women's Soccer Zone, episode 40. My name is Kieran Taveman. As always, I'm joined by my good friend JJ Duke out in Connecticut. JJ, how are you, pal?
I'm good, Kieran. I'm good.
Good man, good man. Got a lot, as always, to pack into this show. Looking at the running order, I've actually written one for this one, which is not a first, but it doesn't happen very often. We've got UEFA Women's Champions League last 16 roundup. We now know who our quarterfinalists are, and the draw takes place at the end of this week. There have also been some moves that have occurred in Europe, which have caught the eye. We'll cover off some of the big players that have transferred to other clubs. We've got an interview with Camille Abeli, a player that I've wanted to speak to for God knows how long, and I managed to do that this week, a little bit on the UEFA Women's Champions League, but also on France, who have a big friendly against Spain coming up this weekend. We'll round up very quickly what's going on in the Under-20 World Cup. JJ is going to take on the role of expert for the NCAA College Cup. We've got a little bit of a roundup of other news that's going on in the US. There was a major trade that took place in the last week. And I'm going to finish off with a name that many will be familiar with, especially if you follow the Houston Dash or you follow your football in Norway. Rachel Axon, of course, an English midfielder who announced her retirement from the game recently. Funnily enough, is from the same town where I work. So I managed to meet up with her and have a chat about her time out in Houston and in Norway, and a few other bits and pieces as well. So after this break, we'll come back and talk about the UEFA Women's Champions League.
Women's Soccer Zone. Follow the show on Twitter at WOSOZone.
So JJ, the last 16 of the UEFA Women's Champions League took place in the last week or so. We now know who our quarterfinalists are. I will round up the results very quickly. Bayern Munich overcame Rosianka 8-0 on aggregate. Wolfsburg overcame Eskilstuna of Sweden 8-1 on aggregate. PSG came through against Kazakhstan's Kazaga 7-1. Manchester City probably had the most difficult time, coming through 2-1 on aggregate away in Bromby. Where else have we got? Rosengard of Sweden overcame the Czech Republic's Slavia Praha 6-1 on aggregate. Barcelona were 5-0 winners over Twente over two legs, and Fortuna Hjørring of Denmark were winners 4-1 over Brescia. Now, I've left Lyon last. They overcame FC Zurich 9-0 away from home in their second leg, adding to the 8-0 that they had in the home leg, which meant a 17-0 aggregate score. Now, JJ, I know that we spoke on the last show about Jean-Michel Aulas, the Lyon president's desire to add American players to his squad. As an American, when you see scorelines like that, we talk about the UEFA Women's Champions League being a highly competitive tournament. It raises questions, I guess, from your point of view and American supporters as to why an American player might want to go to Lyon based on the Champions League when they see scores like that.
Yeah, no. I mean, it's almost laughable. I mean, this is, again, to no disrespect to Zurich. They're a team that are very strong in their domestic league, often enough get to this stage of the competition. But, yeah, if I was an American player right now, if I'm looking at Lyon, why would I want to? It's kind of painful, almost, to play in those type of matches. Sure, you're winning, that's great, but you never, at least from a more often than not American perspective, you don't want to humiliate your opponents, and that is, yeah, that's the definition of humiliation. Now, as you and I talked before the show, this is where the draw gets fun, because when you look up and down the teams in the quarterfinals, there's really not a weak link. Every one of those teams have had success in this tournament before, so, you know, at this point, I think, you know, if this is what you're trying to sell. But that's a very small selling package to go to answer your question about Lyon, because, you know, in and out, week in, week out of the French league, they put up similar results against their competition. Sure, a couple of matches against PSG. UVC is also in there, Montpellier at times. But, you know, you're going to have to sell potentially five matches, with that being the two legs of the quarters, two of the semis, and the one-off final, to be like, this is why you should come here in addition to the money.
I think what was interesting for me is that when you see teams have very heavy wins in a first leg of a competition, quite often you will see them rest players for the second leg. Let's be honest, there was never any chance of FC Zurich coming back from an 8-0 deficit. The Lyon team that played in the second leg contained Eugenie Le Sommer, Jennifer Marajan, Edda Hegerberg, Camille Abelie, Caroline Seguer. They didn't really rest anyone. They went full strength in the second leg as well. And of those 9 goals, Marajan, Hegerberg and Le Sommer didn't get any of them. That shows just how good this Lyon team is.
Yeah, no, you're right. I mean, again, and that's respect. Again, they're respecting the competition as Lyon by playing those strong teams. But when you have Abelie scoring a pair, Lavoge getting a pair, Wendy Renard gets one. I mean, they're getting goals from literally almost every player on the field that's not the goalkeeper. But yeah, you know, again, fair play to them. They went after it and they got the result. But now, again, this is going to be a nice little step up in competition going into the quarterfinals.
Well, we'll come back to Lyon because obviously we've got an interview with Abelie. Looking at some of the other results, I mean, as I said, we now know the quarterfinalists. I think Bayern Munich, an 8-0 win over Rosianka. Rosianka are no mugs, as we would say over here. Russian side with lots of European experience to come through. 8-0 is a good result for them. Wolfsburg again showing their qualities, coming out 8-1 winners over Eskilstuna, who of course finished runners-up in the Damallsvenskan last year. I mean, this is a strong competition, isn't it? Manchester City getting through. I think when you look at them making their debut in the competition, getting through to the quarterfinals, to beat the Russian Zvezda, who have lots of experience in Europe. Bromby, one of the stronger teams from Denmark in terms of their performances and having been in, I think, pretty much every European competition since 2003. The quarterfinals are going to be really exciting, aren't they? Barcelona and Fortuna and Rosengard as well, with the quality they've got. This is going to be an exciting time for those teams that are involved.
Yeah, I agree with that. And I think it's really interesting going back to that Wolfsburg result. That is a very good Eskilstuna team. 8-1 that's a one-sided thrashing right there, because especially going first, what was it, on at home, 5-1 victory? Or no, on the road, it was a 5-1 victory. And then it's just party time in Germany for the second leg, because if you score 5 away goals in any aggregate competition, you're most likely going to be winning. 5 goals being a road team, you're almost guaranteed winning. So I think that result might have been the one that stands out the most, saying that Wolfsburg are here to play this season. And that, I know, obviously, we talk about, again, Lyon being the team, you know, that everyone kind of almost fears. I almost fear that Wolfsburg team just a little bit more, because if they can go out to Sweden against a very good team and put in that type of performance on a given night, that kind of puts a little bit of a shiver down the spine.
Yeah, without a doubt, without a doubt. As I said, draw is this coming Friday, the 25th of November. We will, of course, cover that off on the next show. Now, we'll go to Camille Abelie's interview shortly, but before we do, as we mentioned in the intro, there's been some quite big moves that have taken place in Europe. Now, we mentioned Bayern Munich and them getting through to the quarterfinals. They, this week, managed to sign Swedish youngster Fridolina Rolfö from Swedish champions Linköping. She's had her injury problems, mate, but whenever I've seen Rolfö, she looks a hell of a player. Before she got injured in the Olympics, she looked a really bright prospect as well. And whenever I've seen her for Linköping, really, really, really direct and a big threat for that team. And that is going to add some real quality to Bayern.
Yeah, I mean, you know, you already look at the team in Bayern right now. They've got a strong squad on their own, right? Miedema up front. Leupold's obviously out with an injury right now, or at least as far as I know, she's still out with injuries. Behringer, of course, coming off of that great run that she had at the Olympics. The midfield is pretty strong. I think they probably could have added, you know, another strong forward to that team. I mean, you have Miedema, you have Lutzen, Iwabuchi in there as well. But yeah, I think getting a little extra depth, a little more speed out wide, perhaps that could be that could help them, I think, going into not only the back end of the Bundesliga, but also as well in Champions League.
Yeah, and obviously another player that moved in Europe was Marin Mjelder, went from Alvarez to Chelsea. Of course, Marin is the captain of the Norway team, has over 100 caps for her country, even at the age of 27. That's a solid signing for Chelsea. I like that one because she's also versatile. I think her best position is in midfield, but if they need her, she can play centre-back. That was a statement from Chelsea. May not be the biggest name to fans in England, but that is a solid, solid signing.
Yeah, it is a solid sign. You and I were kind of joking prior to, and I think you said that someone put it out on social media saying that, you know, Arsenal made a big thing, that obviously being Kim Little. Now Chelsea has come in and added to their roster with Mielda. Now they ask Man City, it's your turn. And I think it is their turn. They need to, you know, again, when you look at it, they have a very strong roster as it is, but it's almost becoming a three-way arms race on who can add the big names. Now, we know that Man City have the pockets to go out and spend and get somebody, but who will it be to, you know, break into that team? Because that is a tough team to get into. But then again, Chelsea and Arsenal, those aren't easy sides to get first-team minutes in their own right.
No, not at all. Not at all. Well, those are the confirmed ones. There's obviously a few rumours floating around about other players. We had Pernille Harder on the last show. Obviously, she won the Swedish Damallsvenskan with Linköping. She won some awards in Sweden this week as well. I think she was voted the MVP of the league and also Forward of the Year. So congratulations to her. It looks like she's off to Wolfsburg, mate. She's been linked with a few clubs. Her agent was very open in Swedish media last week, saying that there were a number of clubs that were interested. I think she's got a preference to go to Germany, and Bayern Munich and Wolfsburg have been the two clubs that have been mainly named as being after her. And let's be honest, they're probably the only two clubs that could afford her and attract her. But I think it's going to be Wolfsburg from what I'm hearing. So that is a huge catch for Wolfsburg, because you've got a player there who knows where the back of the net is.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting, Kieran, that you say it about the pay pocket, and now it's really coming down to who's got the money and who's got the budget to go out and spend on these big players. You and I think over the past couple of years, we've made no, you know, we're not holding back and saying that we're hoping at some point we're going to see more and more teams start to develop and start to add to their, you know, the players that they have at their disposal. But let's face it now, as players are getting better and this game is continuing to evolve, it's going to come down to who's going to pay the money, who's going to be the teams that are going to throw out the big dollars to say, hey, you know, we want you in our team and we're going to reward your success by giving you a contract that you can deserve. And, you know, right now, as you and I said, it's a three-way arms race in England. Germany, we always know the players that are going to be there. France, it's always going to be Lyon with PSG following up. Curious to see who's going to be the player in years to come that's going to make the move to maybe perhaps, not to say a middle-tier team, but a team that's just on the outside looking in. But when you have Wolfsburg and you have the money to go after a player like Pernille Harder, you might as well, because that is a talent.
Yeah, and I agree with you in some ways, mate, and disagree in others. I think speaking to Pernille when I interviewed her, I know that she has a preference to play in Germany, not because of the money that it can offer, but because of the competition that it can offer. We see Wolfsburg this year, despite the fact that year after year they are up there, they've had some iffy results this year. It's not as plain sailing as it maybe is in some other leagues. And one of the things that I get a little bit frustrated by, and I do understand people's comments, is people are now becoming a little bit concerned and a little bit annoyed that clubs that have the money are able to attract the best players. For years, we've asked for teams and for individuals to invest in women's football and women's soccer. And now that certain teams are doing that, all of a sudden they're being criticised for buying trophies, in inverted commas, or buying the best players because other teams can't afford them. The reality is these teams are setting the bar. These ones are the ones that teams should be striving to emulate. We shouldn't be criticising them. If Wolfsburg are investing in their team, great. If Manchester City are investing in their team, great. We want these teams to set the bar and raise it higher and higher and higher so that everyone else has to play catch up and everyone else has to invest.
That's something, honestly, that I'm trying to go after. It's not so much that I'm upset the fact that these teams are wanting to buy. It's that I'm hoping that we're going to start to see more teams starting to, you know,
without a doubt,
into their investments and try and, you know, that's where it becomes real competitive. We're always talking about the last eight of the Champions League. Why not the last 16? Why not the last 32? Let's see all of these big clubs in Europe and then going elsewhere in the world add more money, add more resources so that we could have, you know, these true major competitions.
And I know it's hard, and some people will probably criticize me for it, and I take that criticism on board without a doubt before it's even been dished out. You know, I spoke to Jamie Sherwood, the manager of Yeovil Town Ladies, last week, and you'll be able to hear from him on a future show when we do our WSL roundup. You know, he's taking a very small club into WSL 1 next year, and they've got to compete with the likes of Man City, Arsenal and Chelsea, and he's not going to be able to get the sorts of money that they've got available to them. But if they want to be competitive and if they want to be able to stay in that division, then they have to invest. I'm not saying they have to invest loads and loads of money like those clubs, but they have to invest some money, and they have to be able to bring in players that are going to keep them in that division. And it's the same in any other European country. I do not want elite leagues where one or two teams are dominating. That is not what I'm saying. But those teams are setting the bar, and everyone else needs to react to that, because if they don't, then they will get left behind, and that's the point that I'm trying to make. So wherever Pernille Harder goes, I wish her well, because we've interviewed her a few times, and she's a great player, great person, and I really, really hope it works out for her wherever she goes. The only other one that is being rumoured, mate, is Stina Blackstenius. We'll mention her in a minute, because she went wild in the Under-20 World Cup, and it didn't actually mean an awful lot for her team, but she's being linked with a move to either PSG or Lyon. I believe her contract is under review at the moment. She could well stay in Linköping, but that could be another player that leaves the champions. And if they lose Harder, Rolfo and Blackstenius, that is a lot of talent that Linköping need to replace. But we'll see. We'll see. If she ends up in Lyon, she would, of course, be playing alongside Eugenie Le Sommer, and Edda Hegerberg would probably be the replacement for Lotte Schelin. But speaking of Lyon, as I mentioned, we spoke to Camille Abelie a little bit earlier this week, and she has a big game for France coming up this weekend in a friendly against Spain. So I managed to have a chat with her briefly about that and the UEFA Women's Champions League draw coming up this Friday. So here's Camille. So you play Spain in Le Mans this weekend. How has the preparation gone in the lead up to the match?
Preparation is good. We are together since yesterday, and I think we have a lot of work to do, because we saw against England last game. It was good, but it was not enough to win. So we need to improve, and I hope we are going to win the second stage.
I was at that game that you had against England. I spoke to Olivier and I spoke to Laura Georges as well. I know that a lot of younger players were playing in that game. You were unavailable. How different has it been working under Olivier in these early stages?
Yeah, I think Olivier, you know, he was a great player. He loved the possession and the technique. And play forward, I think. So when we play with Bergeron, it was good too, but he was more defensively. He was a goalkeeper. I think it's more that. But so now we work a lot and offensively, and I think we need that, because like we did against England, we didn't create a lot of chances, and I think we need to improve on this on that.
Spain, obviously another team that have qualified for the European Championships next year. The last time that you played them was in Sweden at the European Championships in 2013. I think it was a goal from Wendy Renard that won the game.
Just at the beginning of the game, yeah.
That's right. So what do you remember from that game, and what sort of danger and threat do you think Spain will have for you this weekend?
Oh, I think Spain is better and better each year. They have a very great players like Boquete, and some players play in France in Paris Saint-Germain, so we know them better now. And they love possession. I think both teams like to have the ball possession, so I think it's going to be a war to win this. And I remember it was a tough game, but because we score early, so it was easier for us to keep the ball. And I don't remember a lot if they had a lot of chances. I don't think so. But not much.
Okay. It's been a long year for the France team. You had the Olympics. You obviously had European qualifying. How do you sum up 2016 for the France team, and how much are you looking forward to next year?
I think it was a good year about qualification in European Championship, because we won every game and we scored a lot of goals. We didn't take some, I think. But in Olympics, we are still disappointed, because we want to do better and to win a medal. But we know we have to work more, and we can do something at the Euro.
And talking about the Euros, obviously the groups came out in the last few weeks. You face Iceland in your first game. You also play Switzerland and you play Austria. What did you think when the teams came out and you saw your group?
We were lucky, because we were, I don't know how to say in England, but we couldn't play against Germany and even Holland. And I think it was England. England was the fourth at the top, you know. We couldn't play each other.
Yeah, so, the seeded teams. Voilà, so yeah. what did you make of the teams that you do have?
I think it's every game are hard, but it could be worse. It could be better. You know, we didn't play Sweden or Norway. I think they are very good. So it's a good draw. But after we never know a game stay a game. So it's hard. And now I think Austria, Switzerland and Iceland, they are still better and better, like Spain. They improved a lot last year, so I think it's going to be hard, but if we play at our level, I think we go through.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. Well, my last question, we've obviously spoken about the France team. You, yourself, were named on the FIFA best player list, the 10 names that were named for the best player in the world this year. How proud were you to be on that list? Obviously, the voting has closed now for the supporters to vote, but for you as an individual, as a player, how proud and how honoured were you to be amongst those names, the likes of your former teammate Lotte Schelin and Sarah De Brits and Melanie Baring, are big names on that list, and you were one of them.
I'm really, really proud. Yes, of course, I'm really happy. I was a bit surprised, because we didn't go far in Olympics, not enough at my for me. So I think it's important to be good with the club team and even with the national team. So I was really, really proud and very happy to be on this list. I think Germany's player, I don't know if it's Marozan or Behringer, are going to win. They deserve it a lot, so I hope for Marozan, because now she's my teammate. So
Of course. Of course. And a big win for Lyon in the Champions League against Zurich. The draw is on Friday. Any team that you would like to play in those teams left?
Why not Manchester City? It would be good to play against a great team and a good name. So it would be a nice OL City. You know, I think we can have a lot of people at the game if it's a great name like Manchester City or Barcelona. Why not?
Women's Soccer Zone would like to thank our partners, She Kicks Magazine. Subscribe at shekicks.net for even more women's football.
So that was Camille Abelie. Interesting, JJ, that when I asked her who does she want to play in the quarterfinals of the Champions League, she was very open and said, why not Manchester City? A game that I would like to see, and I'm sure a lot of people would like to see. So, as I said in the a little bit earlier, we will cover off the Champions League draw in the next show. But we'll move on. And JJ, in Papua New Guinea, the UEFA Women's Under-20 World Cup has been taking place. Now, we were being brutally honest before we came onto the recording, because of the time difference, because of the fact that a lot of the games are happening while I think you're asleep and while I'm at work. Haven't seen an awful lot of it, but the quarterfinal stages are upon us. Some people will be listening to this after they've actually taken place, but the quarterfinals lineup at the moment is North Korea against Spain, United States against Mexico, Japan against Brazil and Germany against France. Now, I can't talk too much about the tournament because I've not seen a lot of it, but we wanted to mention it and not overlook it. But the thing that stands out for me, JJ, is that North Korea team. We've just seen them win the Under-17 World Cup in Jordan. They now go through with a 100% record from the group stage in the Under-20. North Korea at youth level are very, very good, and it's interesting as to why they can't translate that form into the senior level.
Yeah, it is. It's always this kind of curious thing. But then again, the country, at least to the West, is very curious in their own right, because we don't know a whole lot what happens in that country. But the one thing that we do know is that when it comes to women's youth international tournaments, they show up and they produce some great teams. And they, you know, you always, when you talk about teams from the East, you're always talking about, you know, their great, you know, ability to possess the ball. They're very disciplined. You know, they build together well as a team, and then they attack with good force. It's not often when they do attack, but when they do, it's very organized and it's swift. And I think, you know, with this North Korea team, 3 of 3, that's about as good as you can want it from the group stage. And now that they have this matchup, which I think will be the better half of this knockout stage, you know, they get Spain, which, you know, I was saying earlier to you prior to us recording that this is continuing this nice little improvement of development in Spanish women's football right now that we saw with the women's team getting to the World Cup. They're going to be playing in the European Championships once again. The youth teams are now starting to get themselves consistently into these competitions and succeeding in these competitions. They're going to be a team that to watch, but I think with them on the top half, they face the winner of USA-Mexico. I'll be honest, I haven't seen much of the USA team, but that is a team that is very not at full strength because they didn't get all the players that they would have wanted to. We'll go into that in a little while from now, but I like their chances in this tournament. I really do.
Well, why don't we do that? Because as we said, we can't focus too much on the Under-20 World Cup because we haven't seen a lot of it. As we mentioned, Japan and Brazil were one of the other quarterfinals. Again, continuing what you said, Japan got to the final of the Under-17 World Cup. They continue to make inroads in youth soccer, but of course have their record on the senior level, which is, you know, something that is not to be sniffed at. And Germany, France, we know two of the major European nations come up against each other, so that won't be an easy one. But you mentioned there the USA didn't have some of the players that they would have liked to be available for them, and that reason is the NCAA College Cup. And I'm going to hand this one over to you, mate, because I don't get to see a lot of this because of the time difference and because there's just so much going on, if I'm being honest. There's so many games taking place. So give us a little bit of a roundup, because there's been some upsets, haven't there? While I haven't been able to see a lot of it, I've been following it as best I can, following people like yourself and Jennifer Gordon, my colleague at The Equalizer, who have a real knowledge of the college system. Stanford, UVA, and FSU, Florida State University, three of the major women's soccer college teams, all out of the tournament.
Yeah, and all out before the quarterfinals. Also, the defending champions, Penn State, as well. We're going to get to that in a second, Kieran, but I wanted to go back. You said why players, you know, the USA under-20s, they're not at full strength. In addition to, it really came down to a choice, play college or you play for the national team. They went through an entire fall of being in a residence. You had the players had the choice. Some elected to play for their national teams, whereas some chose the academics and playing college soccer, because, again, for a lot of these players, they would have to redshirt. They basically, in all essence, they took a semester off of school to be a part of this team, which that's a big decision for a lot of people to make, because that now adds on, you know, to longer, you know, you're going to be in college longer, et cetera, et cetera. But that's one of the reasons why. So you do have some of the players that could have been on that national team are playing in this tournament. So we're at the last eight. Just a quick rundown. Santa Clara and Georgetown in one quarterfinal. The winner of that will get the University of Southern California playing Auburn, which is based in the state of Alabama. And then on the other half, you have South Carolina versus North Carolina. I think people may be a little more familiar, especially across the ocean. To those who don't get a lot of viewing of college soccer, people know North Carolina. They know Anson Dorrance is at the top running that program, long time, many time champion of that of the NCAAs, and then the other, they'll face the winner of Duke West Virginia, and West Virginia have the combination of Kadisha Buchanan and Ashley Lawrence on the team, which is a very tough team to break down. So you talked about upsets, Kieran. Virginia and Stanford both out in the same draw. Santa Clara defeated Stanford 1-0 in the second round and moved on to the Elite Eight, or the quarterfinal round, to 64-team tournament. Virginia beat Penn State, who's the defending champions, who then lost to Georgetown. And that's going to be an interesting matchup because for the first time since 2005, we'll have one team in the semifinals that's not a team of the member of the SEC. The ACC, basically all the big, potent power conferences in soccer.
Why do you think there have been these upsets? We're talking about three big college teams in women's soccer that have been eliminated before the quarterfinal stage. Why is it, do you think, they've all gone out in this year in particular?
Well, there's always going to be, an upset or two. There's always going to be a big team that goes down. I think the balance across the nation is a lot better this, these past few years, as opposed to, years past. You always knew that North Carolina was going to get in there. Virginia almost always was going to get there. Penn State was going to get there. The team like University of Portland, who had, Christine Sinclair and Megan Rapinoe play for their programs, they're not even in the NCAA tournament. So it just shows that, all these newer teams, not to say newer because they've been right there, but now they're taking this next step, and it's really fun to watch.
Okay. Well,
asking for prediction right now, a team to keep an eye on, I think the University of Southern California, they're going to play Auburn in the quarterfinal. USC has Morgan Andrews on their team, a player that's been, I think, a little overlooked in the youth circuit here in the United States, played on the U-17s, but was the last player left off in the U-20s, but I think one of the better, if not the best, technically sound players in the college game right now. So keep an eye on the Trojans to potentially get to the College Cup for the first time.
Yeah, lots of good stuff going on in the NCAA, and I appreciate you giving a roundup, mate. One sad bit of news was that Andy Sullivan of the U.S. Women's National Team and of Stanford did her ACL in the game that she had, didn't she? So she's going to be out for a little while.
Yeah, she did. That's a tough break because I know a lot of people were questioning perhaps would she leave after 3 years. She has 1 year of eligibility left for Stanford. Stanford is a great academic institution. So I think there's going to be a little question if she was going to stay or not, because having a Stanford degree is quite a great achievement in its own right. But I think now this kind of answers the question that, with this long-term injury, she's going to obviously have to rehab. And it's unfortunate because we're just starting to see what she could do for the U.S. national team. Again, in friendlies, not exactly the biggest of competitions, the quality of teams that she's playing against. But still, she's a player that people have an eye on. And hopefully this is just a little small setback and not something that's a bit longer.
No, we wish her well. We wish her well. And obviously be good to see her back in not only the college system or the NWSL, wherever she ends up in the new year, but also the US Women's National Team. And that brings us nicely on to a feature that we saw this week on US television, the 60 Minute program, where they had Carly Lloyd, Becky Salbrun, Kristen Press and Morgan Bryan talking about the difficulties that are continuing with the CBA agreement and what's happening with the whole equal play, equal pay scenario that has been pushed for quite some time now, and it doesn't look like they're getting any closer to a resolution. Do you want to give a little bit of a summary as to what was discussed on that, JJ?
I mean, I think really, Kieran, you just kind of almost said it right there. We didn't learn a lot more. You obviously named the players, Carly Lloyd, Becky Sauerbrunn, Kristen Press, and Morgan Bryan all sat down with 60 Minutes, which is obviously, for those who don't know, it's a major end-of-the-week kind of news magazine program that covers big stories, whether it's in sports, whether it's in politics, business, you name it, it's on there. And you know, they're just they're breaking down the numbers of why the U.S. players are imminently thinking about possibly striking against the U.S. Soccer Federation because of the fact that they have to play nearly triple the amount of matches just to make some sort of, you know, headway in, you know, making money. I think that really brings it down to the point where they showed what, Karen, forgive me if I'm wrong. I know you retweeted it on your own page that Tim Howard during 2014 played 8 matches, most of those being in the World Cup. And he made somewhere close to $400,000 just on his U.S. salary alone with the bonuses in there. And I think Hope Solo in 2015 played nearly 3 times the amount of matches and made, what, $30,000 less in her U.S. salary?
Something like that, yeah. And I think someone said that she had to win those games to earn that money as well.
Because there's the big thing of it. For the U.S. men, here's the difference. If you just get named into a squad and if you show up, you get money. It doesn't matter then if you go play the game, lose the game, draw the game, or don't even play in the game. I don't know what the numbers are, but you get something out of it. For the women, if you win, you get money. If you draw or lose, you don't get anything. Being in the camp is like almost, not to say, and this is, again, I'm going to say this only for myself, not for saying for any organization whatsoever, because it's a great honor to play for the United States Women's National Team. But if we're talking about the money, you get nothing. You get a pat on the back for getting called into a camp. The men, you get money. I think that's really where it comes down to. And you know, the women, they had to win the World Cup or get to the final just to see something. The men, to get out of their group, it's amazing. I think this is it is something, a claim that the U.S. Women's National Team player pool has. I think this is almost a light on U.S. soccer and what they did to almost, I was talking with this a few people, and it's almost like they drew out the CBA going on the men's team to fail. Because, you know, think about it. You want to win a World Cup. If the men win the World Cup, all players are going to be making money probably beyond their wildest dreams. U.S. soccer never probably thinks that they're going to win the World Cup. But the women, on the other hand, they've won three major World Cups. They've won 4 Olympic golds. And they make, what, 3/4 of that, of what the men make just to get out of the group? That's something that's beyond me.
Yeah. Yeah, well, you've taught me something there. I had no idea the players got nothing unless they win a game. That's
yeah, I mean, those were the numbers. I know that, again, I don't have the numbers in front of me. I know that there's a full legal packet on it. If I did get something wrong, that's completely on me. I do apologize for that. But what my understanding was and what they talked about during that piece is that if, you know, they have to win just to get something.
Yeah.
The men, if you show up, you get something. And yeah, that's what they're fighting for.
Yeah, yeah, and you can't blame them. And you can't blame them. And Becky Sauerbrunn was asked the question, would you strike if things don't get resolved? And she was honest. You know, that's a discussion that we will have to have. And let's hope that it doesn't get to that stage, because it might not only affect the US Women's National Team, but those players could potentially, I guess, strike from the NWSL as well. But I really don't know. Well, let's hope it doesn't get down that far down the road, because it would be horrible to see players locked out, because it's happened in other sports. So
and it's happened once in the U.S. before the 1996 Olympics, where a big majority of the team, they went on strike because they only were going to get a bonus if they won gold in that Olympics.
Yeah.
And that's how the story of Brandi Chastain got back into the national team. But that's a story for another day.
Yeah,
she was one of the players that were invited back in because a lot of the players weren't going to play unless they got what they wanted.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's difficult times.
It is difficult. It is difficult. It's not an easy subject to talk about, because this isn't something that we want to have to highlight. We want to be talking about positive stuff and not the negative. But one, I guess, positive for fans of the NWSL, there was a big trade that got people excited last week between the Washington Spirit and the Boston Breakers. We saw Christy Mewis and Cassie Coleman go from Boston to Washington, and we saw Megan Oyster and some draft picks go from Washington to Boston. I put a little poll up on Women's Soccer Zone's Twitter page as to who got the better deal out of that, and I think the majority of people thought it was Boston. What was your take on it, mate?
Push right now for me, to use the betting line. I think it's a push because you and I, we've talked about it. We've said on this show that we believe that Christy Mewis is a talent. She just needs a new environment. We saw that with Steph McCaffrey earlier during the season this year with Boston. She was right there on the cusp of being, you know, a key contributor for the U.S., and then it kind of leveled. The game leveled. Needed a new change. Went to Chicago. We're not going to see really what the full value of how that goes about until probably after this coming season. But I think it's going to be the same for Christy. New environment, new coaching staff, possibly a new role. Who knows? She was phenomenal, you know, and is a great player, but she was really ticking, you know, at the end of her college career into year one of FC Kansas City back in 2013. That was a really strong team that she played on, and she was a really good factor and a really big factor of that side, and then gets traded into Boston. You know, year one was decent, not anything to jump off the page at, but then injuries, amongst other things, started to boil over, and I think it's a good move for her to go. And I think for Megan Oyster to come to Boston, you know, she has an opportunity, you know, to again step into a role and take advantage of it, because, you know, we saw her star shine with Washington last season, and I think now, and that was after a year of pretty hard work. Now she's going to have to come into a new system, but she has an opportunity to impress a new manager, a new team, and one never knows. This could be that next step for her to continue the growth of her game.
Yeah, I'm torn. I think they've both done quite well out of it. I think Megan Oyster was one of the best defenders in the league last year. I know some people disagree with that, but I know she lost her place a little bit towards the end of the season before the championship game, but I think Megan on her day is as good as anyone in that league, and obviously she's again playing a trade down in Australia at the moment for the Newcastle Jets, so getting lots more experience. I think with Christy and Cassie, I completely agree with you. I think sometimes when you've been in a team for a little while that hasn't been winning, it's understandable that it's going to get to you, and sometimes it might affect your performances a little bit. And I'm in no way saying that Christy and Cassie weren't trying, because I think that would be questioning their professionalism, and I'm certainly not going to do that. But if you can get the best out of those two, the Washington Spirit have two very good players in my mind. You've got Cassie, who is a leader, captained the Breakers, I think, in her first season, or certainly was stepped in as captain when other players were unavailable. Christy has talent. There's no doubt about that whatsoever. She's got a wand of her left foot, but I don't think we saw the best of her last year. In fact, I know we didn't see the best of her last year. But if you can get her up to that level that had her in the US Women's National Team a few years ago, that saw her drafted early out of the colleges to go to FC Kansas City, you've got a really good player there. And I think Washington could do well out of that if they can get those two playing. Much like Boston, classy defender in Megan Oyster. Don't doubt for a minute that Matt Beard will probably use the picks that he's got for the draft to maybe make some more trades, because they now have a number of picks for the 2017 draft. But I think they've both done all right out of it, and it'll remain to be seen who comes out on top when we see the three players take to the field, and maybe the players that Matt uses the draft picks for to trade for. So it'd be interesting, really, really interesting. But that's kind of the main trade that's taken place in the NWSL. I'm not aware of any others, unless people want to remind me on Twitter when this show comes out. You'll be thinking, why haven't you spoken about this? Give me a tweet and let me know. But I want to round the show off with an interview with a former Houston Dash midfielder, Rachel Axon. She was, after her release from the Dash, playing her football in Norway with Cobbleton, and she announced her retirement about a month ago, 6 weeks ago, and I managed to catch up with her in London during a visit home to speak about her career and what her plans are moving forward. So here's Rachel. the world of women's football can be a very small one. I'm sat in a pub in South London with a player that fans of the Houston Dash may well know very well. Fans who follow the game in Norway will know. And for those, I don't think there's many that will listen to the show who follow the game in Brazil, but they may remember a very short stint for Rachel Axon, who is actually from the same town where I work. So I wanted to have a chat with Rachel about her career because she announced her retirement recently. Rach, 31 years old and you've announced your retirement. Why?
Oh, it's time. I always said I'd retire at 30, and so I cut it 5 days before I actually turned 31. I think I'm just ready to contribute to society in a different way. You know, I've loved my time in the game, but I want to do something different. You know, off the field, a career, away from the game, meet new people who aren't soccer players. You know, it's a big world out there, and I feel like I'm ready to embrace it.
Well, I mentioned the intro there. You've moved around quite a lot in your career. It's not been a long career in the professional game, but you've moved around. You played in Norway, you played in Brazil. We know about your time in the United States. You had a brief stint in France. It would be so difficult to kind of cover that off in one interview, but you've just finished off your career in Norway with Kolbotn. It was two stints that you had with them, as well as playing for Avaldsnes. What was it about the Toppserien that kind of attracted you there? We'll talk about your time in the States and elsewhere shortly, but having just finished up in Norway, what was it there that really attracted you, and how did you find it out there?
Definitely the scenery. I mean, for anyone that hasn't been to Norway, it's probably one of the most underestimated countries in Europe and the world. I'm a big outdoors junkie, so it's the perfect place for anyone who's into hiking, walking, kayaking. And then just the culture in general. The people are beautiful, very warming, very withdrawn to start with. But, you know, when you get to know them, they're lovely. They all speak English, which makes your transition there very easy. Yeah, it just was somewhere where, you know, I left Oregon with the intent that I would never leave Oregon, and moved to Norway, and the transition was very smooth, and yeah, I just felt right at home from the start.
You mentioned Oregon there. You obviously, as I mentioned, are from South London. You went out to university in the States to start your soccer career. You started off at the University of Alabama at Birmingham. You made the transfer over to Oregon State, and it was actually a game against Notre Dame, wasn't it, where I think you first came into contact with Randy Waldrum, or he first saw you play, and that was what ultimately ended up you, that's how ultimately you ended up playing for the Houston Dash. Talk about the time that you had in the US college system, because we're a couple of months away from the draft. There will be players in that system currently playing in the NCAA tournament who will be hopefully looking forward to making their debut in the NWSL next year. Talk about your time in the college system out in the States.
For me, there is no better place for a soccer player than the US collegiate system. I can say from my experience in, you know, multiple professional leagues, I have never felt more of a professional athlete than my time as a student athlete. You know, just the opportunity to be in full-time training and at the same time to get an education is huge, especially in the women's game. And yeah, I mean, my time in Alabama didn't work out as I hoped, hence the transfer to Oregon State. And Oregon for me was a huge eye-opener. You know, I came, like you said, from South London and went over to the West Coast. And for anyone that hasn't been to the West Coast, it is the best coast. Really good people, very liberal, beautiful. Yeah, I mean, if there was 4 years I could relive, those would absolutely be my 4 years.
You left Oregon. You then had a decision to make as to where you wanted to go. You mentioned that, of course, you had your first stint in Norway. What was the culture difference in terms of the football from what you were used to in the States to what you were experiencing in Norway?
Well, obviously you get the age range. You know, when you're in college, you're within the 18 to 22, I was 24 bracket. And then when you step over to, you know, a league in Norway or England, wherever you're going, you then get the youth, and then you can get people as old, you know, 35, 40. So it's a big mix. And you know, the mentality I'd say in the US is very different to that of Europe. I definitely learned a lot about myself as a player and person. You know, that impossible is nothing. Those times where you think you can't do it, somehow your body can. I think the US, I physically was more conditioned than I've ever been in my life. And whereas you go to Europe and the focus is more on what you can do with a ball at your feet. It's more about playing and understanding the game, whereas the US is definitely more the physical element. The seasons are obviously completely different. You have a 3-month season in college as opposed to in Norway, it's like 10 months, which feels like forever. I definitely loved the whole idea of it being crammed into those 3 months, which gave me the opportunity to then kind of have more of a life outside of soccer, which I think is often quite hard when you're in a really long season.
Talk to me about Brazil. We were having a little discussion about it before we came onto recording. It was a bit of an experience, wasn't it?
Yes, to say the least.
You mentioned flies around meat, if I remember right.
Oh, I don't want to speak too badly. It wasn't the worst experience of my life, but it wasn't one that I will highlight as one of my best experiences. You know, there probably would be no other time I would go to Brazil, so I'm grateful for that opportunity. But in terms of soccer, you know, it just wasn't. It wasn't a place for me. It was a very short stint, and not somewhere where I would recommend players to go, at least from my experience.
How did you end up there?
I had a teammate in Norway who played there actually for 4 years, and it was her team that were asking if she knew of a midfielder who would go there for 2 months. I feel like I can't really go into too much detail with that. But, yeah, I mean, most of the time, any team that you get in contact with, it's from somebody who's been there or somebody who knows somebody. So that was how the network came about.
That team was in Victoria, wasn't it? Victoria dos Tabascos, I think it was. Yeah, something along those lines. Apologies if I've got the pronunciation wrong, which happens quite a lot on this show. I mean, as I said in the intro, a lot of people will know you more so, I think, who listen to this show from the time that you had with the Houston Dash. Talk about the season that you had there, because I know that when you went in, you were, I think it's fair to say, a relative unknown. And the circumstances of you going over there were quite unique as well, because my understanding is Randy Waldrum contacted you initially on LinkedIn.
Yes, that is correct. Good old LinkedIn. Gotta love a bit of social media. It was out of nowhere. Initially, I had re-signed with Colbotton for another season, and then Houston came forward, like, I think 2 days after I'd re-signed, and it was an opportunity that I couldn't pass. And, you know, when I graduated from college, my dream was to always play in the US Pro League, and, you know, it's had its ups and downs, and this was the chance for me to go back to America and to play while I was there. It was definitely a year of highs and lows. You know, the league is so evenly distributed with the players and the results that there's never really a favorite. I love that element of it. You know, you never know who's going to win, and there's no home or away advantage. I think the whole media side that comes with it, you know, it's not often you get to play in front of like 15,000+. But again, you know, you could play at Portland 1 week and it be 15,000, and then the next week you could go to another team and there'd be 100. So there's still that like disparity in crowd attendance, which I know they're still working on. The whole experience was awesome. I felt like a true professional, and
as a Brit, I was over in Houston recently. Humidity is the word that comes to mind. How did you adjust to the conditions there in Houston?
You don't. You know, they say, our coaches used to say to us, you know, we should have an advantage when teams would come and play us. Whereas I don't think you could ever adjust to 90%+ humidity. If anything, when you're training in those conditions, throughout the week, you get more and more tired. I think I was dehydrated for 7 months of the year. Like, no matter how much water I would drink, it seemed to just not help at all. You learn to drink a lot of water, wear a lot of sun lotion, you know, only be outside if you really have to be. I wouldn't say there's much of an advantage living and training there.
You had some characters in that team, likes of Melissa Henderson, Hayley Carter. You mentioned to me earlier you roomed with, or you certainly lived with your host family. Any funny moments, any events that stand out for you during your time there?
Oh, God, too many. I think if you actually spoke to anyone on that team, I think a lot have been quoted on saying this was their favourite team they've ever played for. And I would still stand by that in terms of the personalities and the characters you had within the team, everyone just got on so well. You know, everyone was so different, yet, and offered something completely different to the group, but it worked. You have people like Ellen Massa, who's just absolutely hilarious. Yeah, Haley's a big character, Mel, Ellie. There's too many moments for me to even, like, pick out one. The whole year was a blast, so yeah.
You and I spoke off recording about the reasons behind you not going back to Houston. I don't think it's right that we discuss it on recording, but how disappointing was it that you weren't able to go back for a second year? Because I know that there was an understanding that might have happened.
I think it's just a harsh reality that comes with the game. You know, unlike men's soccer, you don't get your five-year contracts or guarantees, or, you know, it's year to year. It was a blow. It wasn't to the point where I was like, it stopped me from moving on and continuing to play. But I think that the hard part with the US system, and something that I think they need to take on board, is that they don't pay an awful lot of money, and it's a girl's livelihood. And, you know, with a contract actually not, you know, when we think of contracts, we think for the period of time that it starts and it ends, that you will be there and you are guaranteed this per month. And whereas there, you know, that's not the case. You could have a contract and at any point you could be released. And I don't think that provides enough, like, stability and security as a soccer player.
We saw that with Steph Roach, didn't we? Was it 2 months into her contract she was released?
Right, exactly. And, you know, you take someone who has a life and a family and you say, hey, we really want you to come play for us, and you move your entire life over there for 2 months for it to be gone. And, you know, I feel very fortunate that, you know, I got to see a season through. But, you know, I would rather it end then than if, you know, I got there for my second year and 1 month in they say to me, hey, sorry, because then it's too late for me to go pursue something else.
Well, I know overall you were very positive about your experience in Houston, and as a result of not going back, you had a short stint in France before then going back to Norway, where you finished up a couple of weeks ago. As we mentioned, you announced your retirement. I asked why, but how much thought did you have to put into it, and how difficult is it to step away from the field and now say to yourself, I'm not going to be playing competitive football anymore?
It was easier than I thought. You know, I always put a timeline on my career saying, oh, I'll go to 30. And then it went, oh, I'll go to 35. And it's actually really hard to do that because how you feel and how your body is, you don't know. Season to season, you pick up injuries, especially as you get older. You know, recover as quickly. I think it takes me about 3 days now. I always look back in college and I'm like, how on earth did I play 2 games in a week? I'd said that I would retire at 30, and then I kind of passed the 30 mark and did another season. And then it just hit me. I just felt differently about game day and about training. And when you would start, there were days where there were things I would rather do than go to practice. That's when I started to say to myself, maybe it's time. And, you know, I still enjoyed games, but the process, like the process of getting to game day, and that's what I didn't. And it took for me to get to that point. And I think for anyone who is considering retiring, I think you need to get to that point where, not that you dislike the game, but it's just not your priority, that then you're ready to move on. And that's where the point I got to. And then I knew, and I know it's going to be hard, and this is why I've decided that I don't want to coach. That, you know, once I'm done, and you know, sad as it is, I don't want any part in the women's game, because I do think I would find it really hard to watch and not be playing. And so, yeah, I mean, it's very easy right now, because typically now is my off season. You know, I get 2 months where I'm not in training or anything like that. So I think it's going to hit me more so when preseason starts up. And, you know, I have like former teammates posting, you know, training or when their next game is. I think then we'll really know how I really feel about it.
Well, I asked the question a little bit earlier when we first met up about any desire to play in the FAWSL over your career, and you said no, because it wouldn't have given you kind of that travel fulfillment that you get from the countries that you've played in and the leagues that you've played in. And despite the fact that you've retired from football, you're not hanging around in London, are you? You're not going to be sat here in a pub with me come January, because you've decided to go and do a little bit of travelling. Tell me a little bit about the decision that you've made, and where it is that you're going to be going.
Well, having done this whole like traveling and soccer thing, it's kind of opened up all these doors. I have this huge passion for traveling, for experiencing new cultures, for the outdoors, and that's like one of the like real positives that I take from it. You know, obviously I've seen myself grow as a person, but it's also my passion has helped me discover a passion. In January I will be setting off to New Zealand to start with, and I'll be spending 6 months basically traveling as much as I can and as far as I can. My goal is to drive around the entire North and South Island of New Zealand, you know, hike, see everything that there is to see, you know, from there to Asia to Peru, and yeah, just, you know, find out who I am outside of soccer, meet different people who aren't soccer players, just really kind of broaden my horizons.
Now, you mentioned to me that as part of finding yourself outside of soccer, you're going to be blogging about it. For those that have an interest in following your travels and following your progress, where can they read that blog?
So it's called lifewithoutaballatmyfeet.com. And yeah, I started it. I launched it about 2 weeks ago, my last game of the season. I did my first blog, which was actually my retirement letter. I did a letter to soccer and, you know, what it's provided me over the years and blah, blah, blah. And so, yeah, I mean, it's kind of going to become my online diary. And it's a lot more for myself than other people. It's, you know, I think I've always said I would love to keep a diary, and I would love to have one to look back at my growth from, you know, 10 to now, and I never did. And so I think this for me is like the chance to have a diary, and, you know, post traveling for 6 months to see all the things that I did, and, you know, stories that I have to tell, pictures. Yeah.
We wish you well. Enjoy yourself. Don't forget us back here in cold London, will you? And don't enjoy yourself too much, but Rach, it's been a pleasure. I wanted to get you on for quite a while. Wish you well with the retirement. I wouldn't necessarily say it's the last we've seen of you. Players do come out of retirement now and again. They do come out of retirement now and again. But enjoy yourself. Thank you very much. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Women's Soccer Zone. It's all about the players.
So great to catch up with Rachel Axon. Wish her well in her next venture. And JJ, that brings us to the end of the show. Mate, appreciate your time as always.
Of course.
And thank you very much, listeners. Always appreciate you tuning in and your support. Of course, you can give us any feedback or contact us on Twitter on @WosoZone. You can email us on WosoZone@gmail.com. And of course, listening to the show is easy in two ways: on audioboom.com/channel/WosoZone or on iTunes. I will be back at the end of the week with a couple of English journalist colleagues to round up the FAWSL. So until then, take care of yourselves and bye-bye.